Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host for the hour, Michael Slate.
It's now 10 years since the worst hurricane ever to hit the United States, Hurricane Katrina,
pretty much destroyed the city of New Orleans, especially the areas populated by black people and the poorest people. This storm, Hurricane Katrina, unleashed unprecedented destruction when it hit. But more than the damage done, this hurricane laid bare the fundamental oppression and, yes, I'll say it, hatred that this criminal system has for black people. Now, on the 10th anniversary of Katrina, I want to revisit what actually happened, not just retelling the story or listening to the experts, as important as some of that actually is, but through letting you hear the voices and the stories of the people who lived through Katrina and its aftermath.
So I'm rebroadcasting a show I did on the 5th anniversary of Katrina.
I think this is a powerful hour of radio, and more than that, it's an important way to remember and mark the anniversary of this colossal natural disaster turned into a crime against humanity.
So check this out and let me know what you think.
And I have a new email address where you can write to me with your thoughts and opinions. It's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
Now let's take a listen to the stories of the victims and the survivors of Katrina.
Hurricane Katrina and all that happened to the black people of New Orleans during and ever since that storm hit the city was a defining moment for this country. Hundreds of thousands of mostly poor black people were abandoned in the city as the storm hit. Many thousands died. To this day, nobody can really give a completely accurate account of the number of people who did die as a result of this. Many thousands of poor black people were rounded up and held in the Superdome, held like concentration camp prisoners, herded in and abandoned, with no food, water, or medical help. Police and knuckle-dragging racist yahoos set out to hunt black people, shooting them as they sought to escape the city or as they desperately searched for food, water, and medicine. The media painted those trying to survive as criminals, no-count looters, who only got what was coming to them when they were shot. Prisoners were left to drown in jails or simply disappear forever. Hundreds of thousands of black people were driven from the city in the wake of Katrina, the largest forced dispersal of black people, including the forced separation of many families since the days of slavery. Entire black neighborhoods, including many with deep historical and cultural significance, were destroyed in the storm. Houses were destroyed and left to rot, some still with bodies of their former residents decaying inside. Federal housing projects, including some that withstood the ravages of Katrina and the flood, have been shut down or bulldozed down by the federal government. The black people of New Orleans were scattered to more than 5,500 cities across the country, and to this day, some estimate that as many as 100,000 have been unable to return home. This is what we're talking about today, Hurricane Katrina and all that horror and the truth it revealed about how this system views and treats black people. And through it all, hopefully, we'll come away with a much deeper understanding of the nature of this system and why we really do need to get rid of it. I want to bring home the human impact of Katrina, the voices of the people who lived through the hurricane, the people who tell a story that lays bare the genocidal implications of all that was and wasn't done to the black people of New Orleans. Shortly after the hurricane, I visited New Orleans and talked with people who had been left behind to die but somehow managed to survive and stay in the city. I also spoke to refugees from New Orleans who had been forced to relocate to Houston. These are their stories. Gloria was among the first people I spoke with. She was in her early 50s, rail thin, and very, very nervous. She had been sick ever since Katrina hit, and she seemed to always be looking over her shoulder as she told her story, like she knew or suspected that the worst was yet to come, and she didn't want to be taken by surprise.
Why don't we talk about what happened during Katrina? What happened? You were there during the hurricane?
Yes, sir, I was. After the hurricane, we had 2 or 3 days later with the water. When the water really came up, everybody was saying the water was like getting 18 feet high. And around from my house, I'm in a 2700 block, in a 2700 block of Durgin Walk, we have a Washington Apartments, which is a lot of older folks there. I mean, most like senior citizens. So the water was like coming up, and I seen a lot of folks, and you know, everybody was looting and thing. Some young folks had came with a canoe, but as we was, you know, out there, the water was starting getting high and high. So we went around the corner to this lounge called Fox. It was really going Lutheran, but we seen quite a few old people. You know, some of them were stuck in the house, and they had little white rags hanging out the window and thing. So instead of on that job there, we just took the canoe, and we went around to the Washington apartments and started helping those old folks, and we was getting them into the canoe, bringing them to Darren School that was on Russia Blade and Ford, I believe. So we had at least about maybe nine old folks. I mean, I said, I'm talking about between 60 and 70 years old, that we had to get out of the apartments to bring them to Darren School so we could make sure that they were safe. And the process of that, of helping them, when we did with someone, two other folks came, so we left them. And didn't have that many left on the bottom, but they still had quite a few at the top. So as it was getting late, I went to the 17th Ward. And the 17th Ward, the water wasn't that high. So I had my grandbaby and my daughter on the urgent walk, Martin Luther King. So I had to come back up there the next day to make sure that they was all right and see what's the water down. But the water was even higher. And at this time here, I didn't stay in my house at 2706 off Durgin Wall. I didn't stay there. I was afraid that the water would get even higher, which the water was still up, you know, like in my house. But it wasn't like to my bed. So I was like afraid. So I just locked up and went to the 17th on the way back. I went to by my kids like 2 days later, my daughter and my grandbaby. So when I went to see about them, the water was even worse. Let's say the water was like 7 feet high. But my daughter and my grandbaby was gone. In the third ward, it was just like, it was a little deserted. They had quite a few still older folks around them. So I had to walk, me and another guy named Ryan, in the process of walking down to the project. We ran into quite a few people that was dead. The water had to went down a little bit. People was like laying there like they was on like a some of them was on a box as if, you know, they looked like they was just breathing for air or something with their head turned. One lady I went to help her, and she was like laying, she was stretched out. So when I was like, I got to help her, and I was going towards to help the lady, and my friend was pulling me, telling me that the lady was dead, and I was telling the lady was fat. But later, we knew that I knew the lady was dead because she was swollen. And it was so sad, and it was just like, you know, although they had a lot of stoves and things that was open, they had a lot of things that was around and everything, it was just flipped out to see these people, you know, just stretched out there dead and thing, and you couldn't do nothing. You couldn't help them, you know. They had people that couldn't get out to go and get water or ice or anything. They had the Coast Guard and everybody passing around, you know, to get water, but they wasn't giving out ice. And, you know, they was giving out the food, you know, where you could cook it without the stove and everything. But everybody didn't know how to use it. In the process of trying to help these people and stuff, you know, show them how to use it and everything, it was just so hard, you know. When you look around, you have a city that have a lot of cars and things just park here and trucks and things, whereas this city here, you know, you never seen them use a boat in this area. I mean, we talking about like over 4 feet of water. Boats with no, you know, without the canoe that ran by motor. And you have to have them at least over three feet in order for to run that boat in that water. It was just hard. You know, it was, you wondering what to do and how to do things and try to help people and things. And as you're trying to help one folks, you run into another problem. That problem was even worse. One lady, she had the baby. She was sick. The baby was sick. And we didn't really know how to get the baby to the hospital. You didn't see no police calls. You didn't see. Only thing you seen was like the Coast Guards flying in the air in the third ward. You didn't see walking Coast Guard. But in the 17th war you did, which goes more to Jefferson Parish.
Gloria fought to survive Katrina, and she fought even harder to help others survive. She made her way to Jefferson Parish, which was a mostly white parish, and wasn't as hard hit by Katrina and the floods as other parts of the city. At the same time, it wasn't a safe place for black people from other parts of the city to seek refuge. Somehow, Gloria found someone to help her bring back water, ice, and food that she managed to scrounge up during her short visit to Jefferson Parish.
It was just a lot of, you know, they was given at Jefferson that we had to bring back to Orleans to the people that needed that. Orleans Parish did not have any of this. Nowhere. No, sir. They did not have any food or water or ice that they was giving away. Everybody that gave food, water, and ice and everything, they came later. And when they did come later, they wasn't set up like Jefferson Parish. Jefferson Parish at Sam's on Airline, you had to get in the line. They had so much ice and water. Now, don't get me wrong. They still had folks in Jefferson Parish had to come over there to get ice, too. But it wasn't that many. We needed more water, food, and ice and things. And Orleans Parish, we needed this in Orleans Parish that Jefferson Parish had. When we did get it in Orleans Parish, it only lasted for one day. And that was on Carrollton and River Road. The beauty salon, that's where everybody had to go and get it. And the folks that did have to go and get it, it was mostly, I don't know if my eyes just detected these older folks, but it looked like older folks was in more trouble than young folks. It's not on a discrimination thing because I'm over 50, but that's how it was. You know, a lot of them, they couldn't move off the porch, or they was just scared, stung. I don't exactly know. Some of them didn't have transportation. And you just couldn't go to Jefferson Parish, like, talking about it in your vehicle because the police wasn't allowing it. And they made sure that if you had a family in Jefferson Parish, you couldn't go there and live with that family or stay there because it was hard to get in Jefferson Parish.
Let me ask you this. When you said that they wouldn't let you into Jefferson Parish, when did you try to get into Jefferson Parish, and who stopped you from getting in there, and what did they do?
When we tried to get in Jefferson Parish, they had the Coast Guards and things that they didn't have one or two. They must have had at least about 40. They had, like, it's a four-way stop sign, and it's like the Coast Guard 20 on each ground. And they would tell you if you was in a car, you had to turn the car around. If you was walking, you couldn't pass. You could not pass Lee Anders, Monticello, and River Road. You could not pass that away unless you showed a Jefferson Parish ID. If you was from Orleans Parish, you could not go to Jefferson.
Just so people understand, when they send you back, when they won't let you into Jefferson Parish and they send you back to Orleans Parish, Orleans Parish, from what you're saying, was underwater, and there were all kinds of dead people and hurt people in Orleans Parish, right?
Yes, sir. When I say that, in Orleans Parish, you wasn't getting anything in Orleans Parish unless you was going in there, breaking in the store or whatever. It wasn't nowhere that you could say you was going in there to be served. I mean, everything is up in water. So, you know, when you look at it and you right next door to a store and you know nobody in the store have food and you don't have no food, what you support, what, you know, what is you gonna do? We have a store next door to have food. Yes, Jefferson Parish did share what they had for us with the folks who was able to get around. But what about the people that wasn't able to get around? Folks were sitting on their porch. It was like the twilight. You know, what I'm going to do? Mister, it's just, Lord, you would have to be there. When I went back to that city, I could just cry, you know, thinking about some of the people that I went for, you know, thinking I could help them and they was dead. The bodies that floated by my feet didn't really have to go like that. Of all my days and my time, I've been through Hurricane Bessie in 65 and it wasn't nothing like that. Come here, it wasn't nothing like that. It had to be something else that they probably could have worked out better than it went. It's just hurting. It hurts. And when I went back and I sit down there just looking You know, just looking at the city, period. It hurts. You know, it hurts to sit on the porch to look at somebody. If I had a plate of food and I had another person next to me and stuff, you know, I needed to know if they had something. I'm just hurt. And it was the people just seeing them. I see these people, you know, they like a lot of dead folks. It was like some just sitting there by the post as if they couldn't go no more. The ones that was laying on the ground and stuff, you know, they couldn't go no more. And it just hurt.
Gloria started to leave, but turned around to finish her story. She stared straight into my eyes and talked about the terrible pain of being left homeless and adrift.
I'm still messed up because I did on, you know, my house and thing was paid for. You know, my lights would get cut off every now and then because of my income. Sometimes my water would get cut off. But drifting in there, it hurts. And I feel like a drift. Although I have my children, and they help me and stuff. They have a family, you know. My daughter have a husband, and you know it's my grandkids, and I know it's my family. But it's hard because I gotta like accept it, you know. If I got my lights cut off. And when I get my check or whatever, however I might have ran my air condition too much, I knew when I got that check, I could get my lights back on some kind of way. But not having a roof over your head, and you're living here this night, you're living there that night, you don't know what tomorrow or whatever the next day going to bring. It hurts.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. This is a special rebroadcast of the voices of the survivors of Hurricane Katrina.
Demetrius was a large man. Everything about him was oversized, including his heart and spirit. I ran into Demetrius and his friends when I visited his neighborhood. They had been left to die in that neighborhood, and that neighborhood was underwater for days during Katrina. Demetrius stepped up to be a leader in this situation. He helped organize people to figure out ways to survive, and that meant everything from gathering up food, water, and medicine to staying clear of the guns of the police and the military. When I spoke with Demetrius, we sat in what was left of his second-floor apartment, filled with the terrible smells of mildew and walls covered with mold.
Put it this way. If they was in our situation where we didn't have no water, no food, they're telling you not to drink the water. You can't take a bath in the water, but at the same time, you got to eat and survive, and your kid's hungry. A lot of kids was out there hungry. And I'm telling you, people did what they had to do to survive. You got a store full of food, drinks and water, and it's just going to waste, and you're going to sit up there and look at it? No, I'm not. I'm going in there. I'm going in there and get me and my kids and everybody else that I see that's hungry and get it. And that's what this whole block did. Everybody ate. Everybody ate food, drunk water, because they did what they had to do. And that's what people did, because they didn't know what they're going to do. A lot of babies sitting up there crying. They got a baby that had sick going to the hospital. I tried to take two of them out. They turned us away. Say that they're not dying, let them go. They pulled an M16 on me. My name is Demetrius Johnson. I'm going to let you know. I want you to know. I don't know who the guy was at the West Jeff Hospital. They pulled an M16 on me, telling me we got to go. Don't stand. I'm going to sit down. I called. We stopped ambulances and everything. Said they got orders not to bring you to the hospital. You got to get there the way you can. They were doing other things. All I seen them riding around flashing their sirens. That's it. That's all I did. And constables, police officers, firemen, all of them had guns. That's the ones went in the store. Substitute, now, I ain't gonna lie, a couple of cops let us go in the store and get food. Because they seen it was so bad out here. They seen we didn't have nothing. They let us go in the store because they went in there too. They got food, too. They said they ran out of rations, and they went got stuff, too. And that's what they did. And that's the truth. And I hope anybody hearing that about that West Jeff innocent, about them babies, two little babies, 1 6 months, and one was 3 or 4, was sick from smelling this stuff in here, this fungus stuff, and they would not do nothing. And told us to go to Oxinger, and we went to try to go to Oxinger, and they had guns telling us we couldn't go over that way, neither. So what could you do? the baby stayed there. And everybody was tripping together, finding Tylenol pills and everything, trying to get the babies pills and stuff to try to help them from not being so sick. And that's a shame. And I hope somebody do something about that. If you'd have told them cops too much of anything, you was going to be subject to a beatdown. That's for sure. You was going to get that. And if you just, like we, at nighttime, you can't breathe in here. You see how it smells and how it is in here. We go right down that porch to breathe. And when that police car come, if we don't run inside, like they told us before, they will shoot us if we are not inside these doors.
Kimberly was a school teacher before Katrina. She thought she had the life, a happy marriage, a stable job, a nice home, kids, and pets. In Kimberly's mind, it just didn't get much better until Katrina hit. She says it was like someone hitting her in the head with a baseball bat and forcing her eyes open for the first time in a very long time. She was so intent on making sure that people would clearly get her story that she arrived at our interview with a written statement to read.
My name is Kimberly Samuels. I am a victim of Hurricane Katrina. I feel that once again, I have been victimized by the United States government, primarily because I am black and resided in an area in the city of New Orleans where the majority of its inhabitants are black, the Ninth Ward. I'd like to tell you my story and the hell my family has gone through in the longest month in my life. Contrary to what the media has said, those of us who did not evacuate did so not because of a lack of money or transportation, but to a lot of different reasons. Number one, the order to mandatorily evacuate came much too late. Two, too many other storms have people to leave only to get stuck in a gridlock of traffic and a storm that didn't materialize. Three, the love of extended family members, pets, and not knowing what to do with them. My family had been preoccupied with a family reunion that weekend. We had heard about Katrina, but it was in Florida at the time. We left for the family reunion. We didn't make it back home until midnight, very exhausted from our festivities. After putting away all the cooking utensils and other things, we went to bed. The next morning, the 28th, our phone began ringing with relatives from Atlanta, Napoleonville, California, and New Orleans, telling us to get ready. We needed to leave the city. Frantically, I turned on the TV to see what they were talking about. I became afraid and very uncertain as to how I could leave the city in such a short notice. I saw how congested everything was on the highway. I knew it was too late to get out. We would have to leave in two vehicles. My dog, Renegade, had become very agitated, and he wouldn't cooperate with Lola, our lovebird. My husband, MacArthur, told Maya and me to calm down. He said we would go by friends in the St. Bernard housing development. He felt safe that the building would be safe since it had weathered many storms, especially Hurricane Betsy in 1965. We quickly packed a change of clothing, but hindsight said to me, get all your papers and pictures just in case. My husband boarded up the house and laughed that we were taking pictures as though something would happen to our house. After all, he said, this is 2005. The levees have been built up. Lots of money has been spent to make New Orleans a safe place. The storm came, lots of wind and rain, but we heard on the radio that New Orleans had been spared, and we fared out okay. As soon as it stops raining, we are going back home. But something happens to change our plans. We see water rising. Okay, it's going to go down. But no, it continues to rise. We listen to the news, but no one says that the levee has been breached. If someone had said something, we could have gotten into our automobiles and ran for higher grounds. Too late, water, water everywhere, and not a word from any officials. We are frightened. The water is now in an apartment on the first floor. We go up to the third floor. Thankfully, it is empty, and we take refuge there. It is at the end of the day my family and I relive a nightmare 40 years ago. The same thing happened to us as children. The floodgates were open on poor black families in the Ninth Ward during Hurricane Betsy, shutting us off from the rest of the city for months. Surely this couldn't be happening again. I'm thinking I'm educated, middle class, family oriented. Surely the government hasn't allowed this to happen again. We begin to hear stories that the levee broke, a barge hit it. Here I am sandwiched in between the levee at the 17th Street Canal, the Industrial Canal at Florida Avenue, the levee at London Avenue Canal also. How could this happen again? I had read that lots of money had been set aside to prepare the city for a Category 3 or 4 hurricane. I have a friend who works for the Army Corps of Engineers. She told me that Money had been asked for building up the levee, but requests had been denied. How can the government spend millions of dollars for a war in Afghanistan and not care about its own? The thought kept coming in my mind, the home of the brave and the free. Free, I thought. Yeah, free to die like a helpless animal, because that's how I felt. With the help of young black men in the community, we were offered a ride in a boat. These were the young men who had been portrayed by the media as hoodlums. They cared about me. They said, come on, Ma, you have to get out of here. It's already Tuesday. No one has come to give us any food or water, so we need to get you to where help will come. They said to get ready, but we could only take one bag. A decision had to be made, pictures or some bottles of water. Since fared out and we packed our bags with water and essential papers like birth certificates, car and homeowners insurance papers, and we left our only belongings behind. We got on the boat with our dog and bird. After all, they too were our family. We got to the 610 interstate and found pandemonium. People had to get up on the 610 any way they could. It didn't matter if you couldn't walk to get there. On the way to the top was the only way you were going to get help. I saw elderly people crying, unable to walk the distance. Little children were hysterical because no authorities like the state troopers would move their cars and come and put grandma in their car. People start dragging their loved ones up on makeshift transportation like blankets and grocery carts. One lady was just too heavy, and everyone started begging for help to get her up. Couldn't the troopers see that she was in need? But they left bureaucracy get in the way of their hearts. If they helped the elderly, then they would have to not be able to watch us on the interstate. I don't know why they were watching us, because they wouldn't answer any questions, nor did they have any food or water to give us. We had to wait for 2 days until we could get on a bus. We began trading our water with people for food. When exhaustion and frustration took over, my husband kept watching until my daughter and I went to sleep. When they finally came with some water, they threw it at us, though we were animals. When I asked where we were being taken to, I was told to just get in line and stop asking so many questions. Nothing but God's grace kept the three of us together. They just herded us on the bus like a bunch of cattle. Some children got on the bus without their parents. We yelled to the bus driver. He said, sorry, we're about to leave. We'll worry about that later. The kids were frightened. We tried to comfort them and became surrogate parents. It was now Wednesday evening, still no food or water, and not knowing where they were taking us. We soon found out that we were being taken to Houston. We stayed on the bus for 17 hours, still no food or water, until the people on the bus demanded that the bus driver let us off to get something to eat. We were lied to. We were told it would take 30 minutes to process us. It took 8 hours to get us into the Reliant Arena. I was thankful, but we were in a big room, hundreds of people all around us, on cots, nowhere to bathe except in sinks and bathrooms. I felt so depressed. What crime had we committed to let us be treated like this? We were identified by pink armbands. It was then that I was told that I was a refugee.
Kimberly stopped reading. The tears in her eyes made reading hard. I wanted to know a little more about the young guys who had rescued her and her family. After all, these were youth who had been demonized by the authorities, both before the hurricane and especially afterwards. Kimberly's face was taken over by a smile.
Those young people saved our lives. I kid you not. Even when they went to the stores and looted, they came back with water. You know, the first night, they came back with water. And I was so thankful, because what would I have done? Nobody else came to give me any help. And when I saw them with the boats, I was like, I like to ask questions. And I was like, where did you get those boats from? And they were like, don't worry about that, Ma. Say, we got these boats because no one is coming to help you. And we're going to organize and help ourselves. They said, now we got a system. We were like in the middle part of the development. They said, we're going to start from the end and we're going to work our way up until we get everybody out of here. And this one young man, you could see he was so exhausted because the water was like up to his neck. And what they did was they put us in the boat, but they walked the boat to guide, you know, so it wouldn't hit anything and to get us, because otherwise it wouldn't move. And I'm like, how many trips have you made? He said, well, I started making my first trip at 6 this morning, and it was like 8 that night. And you could see the exhaustion. And I said, why are you doing this? I said, do I owe you something? He said, just say thank you. And I was just so touched, because I was like, can I give you anything? He said, just pray. And I'm like, man, this is the little guys, they were saying, little hoodlums back here. And here they are just taking over, making sure we all get out of here safely. And then I was like, well, what's going to happen to you now? He says, well, we're going to stay in the neighborhood another day to make sure that everybody is out. He said, but don't worry about me. We're going to be all right. And I was just so thankful.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. This is a special rebroadcast of the voices of Hurricane Katrina. It's a story of the destruction of New Orleans, and more, it's a story of the genocidal implications found in the way that this system willfully abandoned so many black people in the city to either die or be scattered to the winds. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Diaspora from Kali Z Fasto and Kid Jordan and their album People of the Ninth.
This week we're focusing on Hurricane Katrina, the destruction of New Orleans, and the horrendous treatment of the black residents of the city, followed by the forced dispersal of hundreds of thousands of black people to far regions of the country. Shortly after the hurricane, I traveled to New Orleans and Houston to interview the survivors. This show is bringing their voices and their stories to you. Guy was tall, thin, and walked with a limp. He was hungry and sick. He had a penetrating stare as he tried to make clear how he made his way from the projects of New Orleans where he lived, surrounded by family and friends, to living alone under a highway bridge in Houston.
And a native of New Orleans, born and raised all my life. And while I was born and raised in what we call it, was no longer existed as the Zaya Housing Project, which is the Lower Night War area. And in this particular section, every time a hurricane comes, and I'm a survivor of the hurricane Bessie and Camellia. But every time the hurricane comes, this is where they mostly open the floodgates and let the water go out to see the CB districts.
So you were there during the hurricane, huh?
I was in the middle of the hurricane. It was scary, you know, because me and my nephew in the house alone, and we listened to this wind, we listened to the whispering, we hear people screaming, hollering help, and there's nothing we could do. The rain, the trees, and the trees came through the window, and I watched the water come from one step, two step, three step, four step, five step, six step. So my sister them, her and her family, which got 15 children, they came over to my house, which I was in the Lafitte Housing Project where I resigned at, me and my wife. And me being a diabetic person, dialysis is real incapacitated. I had no plan, no intention of getting in the water because my nephews were there to do everything my sister asked them. So the water went to rising, and they had two old people sit down stairs from us. And they was banging on the door, calling for Mr. Guy. Mr. Guy, come help us because they said the water was rising, coming through the walls in the project, which is in the Sixth Ward area. And it got so severe where my sister and my wife said, well, you got to get in the water now, you know, because you have no alternative, you know. And I watched the water rise. I know I'm 6'1", and the water was like right in the middle of my chest, you know. And I took one lady who was, I found out later on, had the seats, and put her on my shoulder, you know. And like I was telling him, the concrete, you understand, is high, but when you get to the streets, it's low. That's how all New Orleans streets are. So I tell the lady, I'm going to keep your head above the water, and I'm going to go under for a little while, right until I just step right back up on the sidewalk. And I got her to safety. Then I went back, had to get the other lady to safety. Then I had to go back and get her daughter to safety. But I had to go get help because I couldn't carry all these people. Then after that, my little nephew and whatever, when they went at, it took so long, I had to get my nieces them. I put them on my shoulder, me and my brother. And the water was constantly rising. So I told them to go it on, I'm going to stick it out. And they had went on. And so when the water had got so high, I had got stuck in the water. It was like 7 o'clock at night, you know, it was getting night. And I had to take a door and float out. I took a door and floated out, and I floated to dry land because by that time the water had never backed up all the way in the Sixth Ward, all the way in the city, matter of fact, you know. So when I got to Claiborne and Canal, you know, they had very like 2-3 feet of water around the first district. They had that much water. So I got there, and I managed to catch up with them. So it was going to get my sister, who was incapacitated, in the wheelchair on Martin Luther King. The water had never backed up that way yet. But when we did manage to get my sister out the house, the next 2-3 days, the water was 10 feet higher. And like I said, I saw, you know, it's a psychological effect on the kids where, you know, like so many deceased dead bodies. You know, they had one body sit there so long. Well, like I was telling him, the ground was dry. And as the water come up, we went back a couple of days later. I told my wife, I'm going to see if that body's still on there. They had to see the body had floated out with the, in the water, you know. So, and then they had one dude jump to his death off the Claiborne Bridge where he was. You know, I don't know. We don't know how somebody drove him. Or we, some women said they saw him jump, you know. And, you know, the kids had to, you know, cross over bodies, you know. And we had to just tell them to play it off like they just sleep or cheat over them. But the kids know better, you know.
Guy talked about winding up stranded and abandoned on a bridge with thousands of others for 6 days, left with no food, no water, no medicine, and no hope.
We wind up on the Claiborne Bridge for like 6 days. And I had a little niece, she's real incapacitated. She was born that way. And they had forgot the medicine at my house, my other niece. So me and my nephew, we ran up and down the Claiborne Bridge looking for Amalam. Only to find no help. No doctor, no Amalam, no nothing. So the National Guard just passing up and down the bridge, disregarding everybody. Had about 10 trucks pass one time. And we just know they was coming for the help. They was telling us buses coming in the morning and all that kind of. I couldn't sleep the whole 6 days. I couldn't eat the whole 6 days. We had enough provision just for my nieces them to eat. I sat on top of the bridge, couldn't sleep. My wife, she just laid in my lap and went to sleep. And I'm looking at the sky. You could see millions of stars. No lights. All you could hear bodies breathing on the bridge. We're looking over at the Superdome. Nothing but chaos and catastrophes over there. So, when the trucks coming up and down, they just looking. No help whatsoever. I mean, just looking at key pads and blowing it home. Womp, womp, womp. No, it got to a point where my sister told my nephew, she said, y'all got to go do something. So, we went over on the Jefferson Parish side because we was already by the Claiborne, so we walked on the other side of the bridge and went over to Jefferson. Harry Lee them draw down or told us to turn around. Ain't nothing can happen. Ain't nothing here for y'all. Yeah, and we was on the bridge 6 days. And I was getting dehydrated. Matter of fact, when I did got to Baton Rouge, they rushed me to the hospital and they put IV in because they said I was actually dehydrated. And then the doctor said, in a couple of more days, you'd have went in a diabetic coma. Because I ain't had no medicine. It was deplorable. I just couldn't believe, you know, it just was a situation where I wasn't ready for. But it wasn't so much as the storm, you know. The storm brought water, but not all that water. They opened the floodgates, and the water backed up. I mean, when I say backed up, back up, I mean, well, the city looked like part of the Gulf. And they had bodies just floating.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is a special rebroadcast marking the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and featuring the voices and stories of those who fought their way through to survive in the face of both the devastation brought on by the storm and the system that left them to die or be killed fighting to survive.
Guy continued on with his story, explaining how he ended up completely separated from his family, no idea where most of them were, and living homeless and one step away from needing hospital care. He talked about what it was like to be left on a bridge, surrounded by deep water and waiting to die. And as he talked, he started to hit at who were the real criminals in all this.
So what they done, they separate the family, took my family, sent them somewhere, took me and sent me somewhere, you know. And I think it's a crime human man, regardless of what they see. I'm just as well up America as anybody else, you know. And they try to talk about the criminal, who's the criminal and all this. Yeah, but they got to realize America was founded on criminal activity. The first president was a criminal. So they can't point them, you know, in this case, they make the victim seem like the criminal and the criminal seem like the victim. That's the way I see it right now. I see this here, you know. I think it's a crime humanity, and I think things should have been dealt with much more better from the local governor on up to the big governors, you know. Now, everybody ran out of food and water. They had people so incapacitated on the bridge they couldn't do nothing. You know, everybody just laying there for days. Man, you know, my heart was heavy, you know. And, you know, I was just walking up and down, feeling bad. I ain't slept in 6 days when I was on that bridge. Walking up and down, just looking at everybody, just saying, wow, we... Because you know you couldn't go down this, you couldn't no longer go down Martin Luther King way because that water had got like 10 feet. You couldn't go my way to water like 10 feet. So we stuck in the middle, waiting on somebody to come to rescue. I mean, they just constantly passing us up, constantly passing us up. And I said, "Wow, a lot of people was crying and saying they don't want to die this way. I don't want to die like this. I don't want to die like this. Somebody ought to come. They keep telling us the bus is gonna come." I don't want to die like that. Wow, it's hellish, you know. You know, it's like the movie Today After Tomorrow or Armageddon or something like that. That's how I looked at it. You know, we on this bridge, 2:30 in the morning. Not a light, not a peck of light. You could hear bodies, people just breathing. Some people had their personal calls up there, thought they could save it, trying to save it from the water. you can hear music on, but you can hear the body beat, you can hear the people suffering. And when you just look in the sky, I never knew to this day they had that many stars. That's how dark it was. The stars was like just shining, you know. And I said, wow. My wife said, wow, that must be how many souls was lost during this Katrina incident, through the storm. I said, I don't know what it is, but I could see some stars up there.
Guy also talked about his attempts to get help in Jefferson Parish.
Cold shoulders. You know how you say you're cold shoulder person? You know, we from Orleans and they from Jefferson. You understand? We didn't neighbor, but when we go over there, I guess about to be in Africa, America, so you understand? Turn us around. No help.
Who turned you around when you tried to get into Jefferson Parish?
Well, a lot of Jefferson Parish policemen. Because Jefferson Parish didn't hardly got no water. So their police force was like, you know, still deep, still strong. Nobody have abandoned the folks and nothing. Harry Lee stood there with him, even though he had got sick too. It was his people, through his orders, to turn us around. Don't let them come over here, because they know eventually what was happening with them order with the water. The water had trapped all us on the bridge, and they know we were going to run across that. So we already had given the orders. Don't let them come over here to try to get nothing. That's how that was. They cold shoulders.
Now, Harry Lee is?
The chief of Jefferson Parish.
He's the police chief?
He's the police chief. Over there in Jefferson Parish, Harry Lee run the streets in the jailhouse. You know, he's just one sheriff over there, that's just him.
Now, when you said that the Jefferson Parish police stopped you and turned you around, how did they do that? How did they stop people from coming in?
Oh, very belligerent. Very belligerent at gunpoint. Very hostile. They had to take the guns off because there were so many people coming at it. No diplomacy. They didn't use no diplomacy at all. They dealt with us just like what we was, blacks.
People must have tried to tell them, look, we're starving. We don't have any water. We just got to get that. Did people tell them that? And then what did they do? What did they say?
Well, not only people told us that, we had money where we wanted to buy some of that. And they just had enough provision for what the people that resides over there in Gypsy Parish. We ain't got nothing to share with New Orleans. We got enough provision over here just for us, not for the New Orleans evacuees. And that's how they went. No diplomacy at all.
So you have no idea, you have no contact with your family at all, huh?
No contact with my family at all. My family just, you know, it was like... Something I read about, you know, during slavery, you know, they just asunder the family, they separate us, split us up, some up no, some this way, some that way, you know. No.
Let me ask you one last question. In your heart of hearts, when you really think about this, why you think they let this happen?
Most of all, because I could see one reason, separate reason why. First of all, to play the race call. Second of all, we was, you know, poor black people. Living under relegated conditions, proletariat class, the working class, you know, people on welfare, you know, stuff like that. Always looking for handouts from the government, Social Security, and the fact that, you know, we was not that important like the other important elites of New Orleans was, and the fact that, you know, they try to say most of the crime come from the poor neighborhoods, the black communities, you know. And when this here happened, I think that was a good time for them just to slowly respond. In other words, it was a camouflage genocide, you know. It was a camouflage genocide. I guess that was their way of letting some of us die off. And like I heard the statement with the man said the other day, just, you know, stop the birth of the black kids, the black babies, and that'll annihilate some of the crimes. I think that's how they look at it. But, you know, they got to understand the history of America. I don't think, when he said that, I don't think he studied and read the history of what America was founded on, criminal activities, you know. And I think because of we of Africa descent, or Africa, Americans, and poor black people, you know, always in need, or, you know, and what they think that, they say we lazy, we are inferior, we, you know, all the labels they try to put on us. I think it was a race call played on us, and so, you know, it was a lot of premeditated. I don't know the word I want to use, but it was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy to destroy the black race, and this was the time. This is the time to do this, and this was the opportunity. And I think that's what it was. You know, it was so tangible. You see what I'm saying? It was so tangible. You know, well. Even the blind, if they couldn't see, they felt it.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and this week we're featuring the voices of people who survived Hurricane Katrina and the genocidal aftermath brought down on the black people of the city of New Orleans by the U.S. government and the capitalist system it serves. I met Annette in Houston. She was at the end of her rope, resigned to dying when she and her sister were found by her brother and evacuated from the city of New Orleans. When I met Annette, she was staying with a 90-year-old black woman who could remember her grandmother telling her stories of what it was like to live in slavery. When this woman saw what was happening in Katrina, she immediately made the connection between the slavery of the past and what was being done to black people in the wake of Katrina. She opened the doors of her home to 40 people evacuated from New Orleans. Annette and her family were among them.
My name is Annette Addison. I live in New Orleans East, East New Orleans. During the storm, hurricane, Katrina, I was there afterwards also when everything went on. Okay, I was trying, me and my sister, we was together, and we was trying to get out of New Orleans. When they said they were sending helicopters, they were sending buses and everything for to help us to get out of New Orleans. We didn't have no water for 3 days. We didn't have no lights for 3 days, and we just was trying to get help. And me and my sister, we went to the firemen just to ask them just for a little water because we was exhausted, we was dehydrated, and we needed water. And when we went to the firemen to ask them for some water, he told us that they didn't have enough water for nobody but their men, the workers. So they sent us away. We saw the police in a car. We flagged the police down. We asked them, do they know where we can get something to drink, or do they have any water, or do they know where we can get some gas or something for? They said no. They passed us out. Me and my sister went back to the house. The house, no water, nothing to eat, no lights, the house hot, trees and everything been pulled up from the root and everything. It just was a disaster. Well, anyway, we went back up in the house. We waited a little while. So hot, I mean, I kept passing out, go outside. I kept passing out on the cement for no reason. Passing out in the house. My sister had to keep on picking me up, and then I had to lay there a while because she was dehydrated before she can even try to help to get me up. We heard a helicopter. She went to one end of the hallway. I went to the other end of the hallway, and both of us had a rag, and we went to flagging the helicopters down because they said we can flag them down. They was going to pick us up. You think the helicopter stopped to pick us up? No, they did not. We saw army men in the green big trucks, a whole lot of them just coming down the street. We just know we about to get rescued right there. And we were saying, hey, 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 thinking they're going to pick us up. We need help. You think they stopped to give us a ride? All them green trucks just followed their way on down and passed us up. Wouldn't give us a ride and stuff. I mean, it was just a disaster down there. I mean, the police was just treating us. They just treated us just like worse than criminals. And I stayed down there because we didn't have no ride. My family went ahead, and I saw some of my turned ahead, and I stayed there waiting for my son because my son was in Orleans Parish Prison. Before Katrina came, he was due to get out because they took him for somebody else, charged him for somebody else. So he was in there really being charged for somebody else, but they was dropping it down to death. Okay, they was about to let him go. But Katrina came, called all over, couldn't find my son. My son is out now. But my son got, he said when he was in a jailhouse, that he said they had water. He said, Mama, they had peepers dying all in a jail. He said the only way he survived, he had to swim. He said the water was so high, he said he had to swim. And he said the police, some of them was trying to run, some of the prisoner. He said the police was just shooting, just killing them on the spot, just killing them on the spot, just killing them on the spot. My son is here, okay. And then he got, from all that water and all them dead bodies they had to push on the side and stuff, he got stuff all over his leg, fungus. He got like fungus. I don't know what it is, but it's all over his body. Okay, when he was in jail, they told him it was some kind of fungus or something, and then he got big old knots on him with holes in it and stuff from all this here. You think they treated him? No, they did not treat him. You think they took him to the doctor? And you know in jail they have a place where they treat you. No, they did not. They treated them like low-down dogs. My son said, Mama, I never saw nothing like this in my life before. And my son got stuff all up his legs, all on his arm. He got big old knots with holes in it and stuff. I got to get him to the doctor behind that.
Annette wiped her eyes as she talked about reaching the bottom and feeling like that was the end, and the total joy that swept over her in seeing her rescuer come up out of nowhere.
Now, my sister's a nerve patient. Me and her was left behind in New Orleans. She was sick on one end. I was sick. She was crying on one end and wouldn't let me know because of what we was going through. I was crying on the other end and didn't really want her to know what I was going through, but she already knew I was sick because I kept falling out on it until we got together later and we was telling each other that we was hiding from each other, crying and everything. And then when we went to the helicopter, now both of us did cry with each other when we went to the helicopter. When we went to that helicopter and them helicopter wouldn't help me and my sister, I tell you the God honest truth, it just took something out of it. I say, Lord, how in the world could these people do us like this here? I have a two-story home, New Orleans East, a two-story home. My whole home went under. And I mean, I've been in my house 10 and a half years, almost 11 years. I never in my life experienced nothing like this in my life. But them people took and treated us just like we wasn't even us humans. They just took advantage of us. And I mean, the way they treated us, it was not cause for. The way they did my son, it was not cause for. And the way they did me and my sister, it was not cause for. Now, you know, she had an old car that wouldn't stop, but it wasn't nobody but the Lord had the car to stop, but we still couldn't go nowhere. Everywhere we went, we couldn't get no gas. We couldn't get no gas nowhere. We even asked the police now, do they have a little gas where they can give us, where we can try to get somewhere where we can get some gas, like in Lake Plaza, somewhere where we can get some gas. You know they had big gas cans, and you know they wouldn't give us no gas? They wouldn't give us no gas to help us no kind of way. So me and my sister, we really thought we was going to die. I really thought we was going to die. I'm going to tell you the God honest truth. And then I was just cry. I said, oh, Lord Jesus. I said, part of my church is in Houston. I said, Lord, I stayed down here. Me and my sister to see about my son because he was due to come home in the day. I said, oh, Lord, have mercy, Jesus, because I thought we was going to die. I'm just going to tell you the truth. I thought I wasn't going to see my churners again, and we was dehydrated, no food, no water. I just thought we was going to die. I was just praying to the Lord, but in the meantime, I was really giving up. But I was praying to the Lord because I know he is the only one who can help and who can get us out of this situation. Even though it was 3 days later, my brother. Now, I ain't know at the time he had turned around because they had so many cars. I think they had about 15 cars going to Houston because I had sent some of my churches ahead of time, like I said. About 3 days later, he came. When he was able to get through the trees and all through the water, whatever, he came over there in his little car. I was walking. My sister was in the house. I took the walk. I said, Sibby. Her name is Sylvia George. I said, Sibby. I said, I'm going to go up here. We couldn't get out of 504. We couldn't get out, use the phones and everything. So I went to the payphone, and we kept trying. I said, Sibby, I'm going to go up here, and I'm going to try to use the payphone. All right. I left her in the house. She said, Annette, you can't go out there. You keep on falling out. And Annette, she said, I can't keep on helping to pick you up because I'm sick myself. I said, Sibby, I'm going out here. I said, I don't care if them phones ain't working. Sibby, I'm still going out here to see can I use the phone. Sibby, we need to get out here because, Sibby, we don't get out here. Sibby, we going to die. Okay, when I went out there, head to the payphone. I saw my brother. My brother came on in and he blew the horn. Bam, bam. When I saw my brother, I said, ooh, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. When I saw my brother, okay, my brother came up in there and I hurry up and went knocked on the door. Seven. I said, Lamar here. Okay, but when my brother came, his car was all flooded out, full of water. The floors was full of water. The seats was full of water. But still, the car, he said, he don't know how that car started working, but the car started working. We had to put blankets on the seats, plastic bags on the seat to get out of town. The seats was so wet, the blankets got wet, and even the little plastic garbage bags we put on there got wet. The floors was full of water. We didn't care. We got soaking wet coming up here in the car, smelling so bad or whatever, but the Lord still blessed us to get out of New Orleans, to come and make it up here to Houston and stuff.
Annette's voice lowered, and her eyes seemed to be looking far away as she talked about what it was like to be facing what she thought was certain death, either through illness, starvation, and dehydration, or at the hands of the police and the military.
Well, to be honest with you, I thought I was going to die, me and my sister. I just know we was going to die. But in the meantime, I was asking the Lord to please help us, okay? Going to the fire people, when they turned us away, ooh, it took such a toll on me. I just started crying. And my sister said, Annette, come on, it's going to be all right. But she was crying too, but she wouldn't let me see her cry. I would just kept on breaking down, crying for no reason and stuff. Okay, when the army trucks pass us, that just make us cry. We was dehydrated. I'm just going to tell you the truth. I just know we was dead. I just know we was dead. We didn't have no water. We was dehydrated. You know, we made it to Houston, and we seen the doctor. You know what? Her pressure was up high. My pressure was 148, I believe, over 139. Her pressure was up real high and stuff. I had a panic attack, a stress attack, and I was threatening a stroke. And then I was under an anxiety attack
from all this we was going through. And even after I got to up here to Houston, you know what was still going on? I still was passing out. I still was falling out. Even when we got here and then we received help from Maxine Jackson, we received help from her. She fed us food. She gave us drink. She took us in. She let us sleep. We all slept on the floor wherever we could sleep, but we was grateful because we had a household where this lady taking us in and fed us and gave us something to drink. But even during that course of time, I still was passing out. I still had crying spells for no reason, just crying. Same thing with my sister and stuff. We just thought we was going to die because the people we thought down there was supposed to help us, the fire people, the policemen, the people in the green trucks, all these people, the ones were supposed to help us, they failed us, and we thought we was going to die. And even the prison system who had my son up in there, they just was killing them all up in there. I say that's a low-down crying shame. I want this to get out to somebody, whoever, the president. He wasn't even doing what he was supposed to do. All us was down there dying and everything. We done gave up hope. Didn't have no hope or nothing. And then Bush gonna lay down, come on the scene like he helping us, talking about giving us so much money. What can money do? Money can't help us. I done lost my home, thinking my son dead, me and my sister about to die. What can money do us? Money can't help us. I done lost everything. I done lost everything. And what did Bush do? Nothing. I saw the people he sent down. They did not help at all. Because me and my sister, we flagged the army trucks down. We flagged the helicopters down. We went to the firemen. We went to the fire department. We went to all of them, the police for help. Everybody failed us who Bush sent down there. They failed us. So we was a dying people in a dying city. We was a people being murdered. That's what I say. We was a people being murdered. I rephrase that. A people being murdered. That's who we was. A people being murdered.
You've been listening to a special edition of the Michael Slate Show marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
With all the devastation and destruction that it brought down, and even more, all of the inhuman and terribly oppressive acts against the black people of the city of New Orleans, and by extension, against black people everywhere, by the government and the system it serves. Hurricane Katrina pulled back a curtain and revealed a whole lot of truth. And chief among those truths was how much this world cries out for fundamental change and revolution. The idea that we can't do any better than this is a terrible, terrible weight that we live under. But it's also just not true. We don't have to live like this. There's a whole better way we can and should be living, but we've got to start fighting now to bring that world into being. This week we featured the voices of survivors of Katrina.
And these stories call to mind this quote from Bob Avakian. There will never be a revolutionary movement in this country that doesn't fully unleash and give expression to the sometimes openly expressed, sometimes expressed in partial ways, sometimes expressed in wrong ways, but deeply, deeply felt desire to be rid of these long centuries of oppression of black people. There's never going to be a revolution in this country, and there never should be one, that doesn't make that one key foundation of what it's all about. That's from the book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. All right, once again, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at my new email. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
We're going to go out now with Katrina Blues from Marva Wright. Talk to you again next week.
It was 2005, August 29th. That's when my world came tumbling down. Katrina gave a party. FEMA was a